I'm Dave Cawley, investigative journalist and host of the podcast, Cold. Don't miss Cold's new Season 3, where I look into the unsolved disappearance of Cherie Warren, a woman last seen leaving her job at a Salt Lake City office in 1985. Police cast suspicion on Cherie's estranged husband and boyfriend, but never made any arrests or recovered Cherie's remains. Find Cold Season 3, The Search for Cherie, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Welcome to another episode of Relentlessly Resilient, where real people share their real life experiences and the tools they've developed to move forward and live their best lives. I'm Jenny Taylor.
And I'm Michelle Scharf. We'd like to acknowledge today that we have a guest producer, Tom Craner, and we really appreciate his expertise recording our show today. Our guest is Maurice, and she has a tragic story, one filled with a lot of hard topics, love, domestic abuse, suicide. And she's going to be sharing with us her story today and how she overcame the challenges of her first marriage and subsequent loss of her husband. Maurice, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me here. What I'm about to talk about is really personal, but the purpose of it is I hope to help someone else who may be going through the same thing that I went through, give them some sort of peace, some sort of hope to know that you can get past the situation that you're in. But my story really began when I was just 17. I lived in Canada, and I had met this boy who I thought was the most amazing young man I'd ever met. He was unlike any boy that I had ever had any contact with. He was kind, he was confident, he was athletic, ambitious, smart, handsome, and the most important thing to me at 17, he had his own truck. So the first night I met him, he told me that he was going to own his own home by the time he was 30, and it was going to be mortgage-free. He was going to own it mortgage-free and not just... I mean, maybe that tells you a lot about myself, but at 17, that was, like, pretty cool.
Like, how many high school kids even think about that?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, nobody.
Exactly.
Yeah, so, usually kids in high school are not thinking about long-term future plans like that. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah, so I was smitten right at first. And I just loved any amount of time that he could spare for me. He was so busy. He was only 16 years old, too, but we were both seniors. We were going into our senior year of high school. But he was... he was on his high school football team, and he was also the reigning Golden Glove champion for all of Canada in his weight class. Wow. He had won that title 9 years in a row, and he was also an honor student, and he had two jobs. And I don't know when he slept, but he certainly made me feel like I was special, and I couldn't wait to spend any time that he could give to me at all. So the really cool thing about him was that when you met him, you knew that he was going to be somebody. There was just something special about him. And our kids all inherited that quality, and I see that in them every day. So he, I was smitten. Just obviously, I was smitten. So we were high school sweethearts, and we got married 2 years, almost exactly from the day that we met. And our first year that we were married was crazy. I was 19, and he was 18, so we were just so young. He was in university, and he was working, and he was also traveling the world with the Canadian Olympic boxing team. He had lost the Golden Gloves title that year to his competitor, but because that guy thought he was too busy because he was in university, he allowed Curtis to fight at the international level for him. So that first year, Kurt went to Thailand, to Africa, to Spain, France, and Italy. And also at the end of that first year, we had our first baby. But on his very last tournament, he came home different. He was changed. He no longer was passionate about boxing. Someone on the Olympic team had gotten knocked out and was in a coma. And it just scared Kurt, and he just said he didn't want to do it anymore. So after we had our first baby, he only fought one more time, and then he was done. So after 10 years of boxing, he was finished. And he decided he didn't want to go to university anymore. He didn't want to be a teacher, but he wanted to own his own business. And the next chapter of our life started. He went to school to become a carpenter, contractor, and at the age of 20, he started his own business. And he was about 23, and he built us our first home. And we went on to build 5 homes over our married lifetime together. And it was an adventure. It was fun. It was exciting. It was scary. I mean, it was
probably
scary.
Crazy and stressful.
It was.
Anyone that's ever built a home. And when you're physically building it, not just hiring someone to build it, that's a lot of work.
It was.
You know, I totally relate because my husband was a general contractor, and we built and remodeled homes that we lived in. And, you know, it's also fun.
It's,
I think it takes a certain personality. A lot of people dread it, but I love it. I love building. So, it's exciting.
So build and then sell and then build and then sell.
Yeah, we would live in it for 2 years and then put up for sale. So my home always had to be clean because it was always show home ready and...
And, it would not work at my house. Keep talking.
especially with young children, right?
So that was the first 20 years.
Yeah, you would have had young children. You were young when you did that. Oh, bless you.
Yeah.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm just thinking
fine.
What a disaster it would be if I had to sell my house and move every 2 years. That makes me really tired.
Well, we lived in a small town, and so we wouldn't. It's not like when you put a house up for sale in Utah where it's sold, you know, a few days later. It would sometimes take us a year or two to sell a home.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was a long process. So five homes took us, you know, 20 years to cycle
build,
through.
To live in for a minute, to sell. Yeah.
So that was what our first 20 years was like. Chaotic, wonderful, stressful, just like normal.
Fast.
Very quickly. Yeah. And then that took us to the last 3 years. When he was about 37, that's when everything really changed.
All right. Well, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to hear about the challenges of the next, which would be the last 3 years of Maurice and Curtis's marriage, and hear how things progressed. We'll be right back.
It's the story of an American held in a dark Venezuelan prison.
Then all of a sudden, they all kind of lined up. They pointed their guns at me. And this is the point where I thought, I'm going to die today.
I'm Becky Bruce. I spent a year working on Hope in Darkness, which now has more than 2 million downloads. Find it on KSLpodcast.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
And we're back with Maurice, and she's just shared with us the passion and love. You can hear the passion and excitement in your voice when you talk about him. And I'm sitting across a very large table from you, socially distanced, of course. And it's fun to see you light up and talk about the love that you had for Curtis. And clearly, you still love Curtis. And there's a lot of passion in remembering these things. And we're really glad that you're here to share with us. The next part of what you're going to share with us is probably pretty difficult. It's the last 3 years leading up to some really difficult times for you. And why don't you just take us away?
Okay, well, when he was about 37, we noticed a change. He started to struggle with a loss of memory. He had aggressive behavior. He was unable to comprehend really simple situations. He became extremely jealous. He had suicidal thoughts. He had headaches. And he just overall became more frightening, a complete change of who he was. I knew that for my safety and the safety of my children that I had to be really patient and just not put down, you know, put my foot down with a lot of things, but just be really patient with whatever was happening to him. And I knew that the only way to keep control of my situation was to stay in my marriage and to try to control my surroundings from within, because I did know what he was capable of. And I know that a lot of women that are in abusive situations, they have the power to leave, but I did not have that power. I knew that for the safety of my family that I had to stay. So over the last 3 years, things started to progress, but about the last 4 months of his life was when things got really terrible. It's when I was unable to hide it from other people around me and my kids. I mean, I thought I was hiding it from my kids. It turns out I wasn't doing as good of a job as what I thought. But the last 4 months is when it really, really changed. But he became very suicidal. He was constantly denying it. He would tell me that, oh, he really wasn't suicidal, that I was making it up. He played mind games with me to make me think that I was the one that had the problem and that it was not him. And if trying to tell me that, like, his odd behavior was somehow my fault and that I was just trying to be too controlling of everything that he was doing. He never slept. So he would leave at all hours of the night, and he would just drive around. And things really began to escalate. So at this point right now, we're building our last house. This is our final dream home. This is what the last 20 years have all culminated in. And so things are really stressful because it's a big house. It's not the same type of house that we've built in the past, but there's a lot of work to do. But he had developed this pain in his shoulder and had gone to the doctor and was told that he had a blood clot somewhere in his body, and that he had to get to the hospital immediately that night to have a shot of Coumadin, a blood thinner. And so he went to the hospital, and he very politely declined any treatment and just left. And he went home, and he grabbed his gun, and I was trying to talk him into, like, why are you leaving? Why are you taking a gun? Just stay. And he was very angry with me and just left. And it wasn't that big of a deal because he was always leaving and he always brought his gun, but he didn't come home that night. And the next morning, I made phone calls, and we had friends who was a retired police officer who actually had known Curtis all his life. And he told me to just call the police and tell them what was happening. And because he hadn't been gone 24 hours, but they would still pull him over if they saw him and tell him, hey, you know, if your wife is worried, can you just call home and let her know that you're okay? So that's what I did, and never got a phone call. No one ever found him. And so we waited that whole day, and the kids didn't go to school. We drove around trying to find him, thinking of all the places he could go. And, of course, we never found him. And then I had a thought to call his work visa and to see if he was making any charges on it. And I found out that he had filled up with gas about 8 hours north of where we lived, and his grandmother lived there. So I knew he had gone to visit his grandmother, so I called her. And she just told me they had had this wonderful visit, and he was happy, and there was no problems. And I didn't tell her, you know, what had happened. I didn't want to worry her, but I knew that he had gone to visit her to say goodbye. Mm-hmm. So we waited for him to come home, and he came home the next morning and acted like nothing was wrong. And so I called his dad and told him, you know, Kurt's here, and his dad rushed over, and the kids had stayed home from school again, and they were upset and wanted their dad to get treatment. And they were at the bottom of our stairs telling their dad, like, just go get help, stop being so silly. And his dad was there saying, if you don't get in the truck with me and go to the hospital right now, I'm going to call the police myself. And Curtis was laughing at the kids because he thought they were mad at me. And I was trying to explain to him, no, they're not mad at me, they're mad at you. But he couldn't comprehend the situation. It was like trying to talk sense into a two-year-old that was in the middle of a tantrum. So I finally just called the police to see, what can I do with a husband that refuses to seek medical life-saving treatment?
Right, yeah.
And they told me...
What do you think was going on through it? I mean, do you have any idea?
I know. He had told me later that he was thankful that he had a blood clot, and he thought this was his answers to his prayers that he could finally die naturally and not have to do it himself.
Oh, wow.
So that's what was going through his head.
Wow.
And he had read somewhere that if he stayed sitting for a long period of time, that the blood clot might progress faster or get bigger. And so that's why he had gone on a long drive to see his grandma.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's what was going through his head. So the police told me that if I could get a letter from his doctor stating that he required this treatment, that I could have him forcibly arrested and brought to a psych ward for an evaluation by two totally independent psychiatrists. So I went and saw our doctor. I got the letter from the doctor, brought it to the police station, and like from within an hour of him coming home that morning, he was taken to the hospital, to the psych ward. And taken in the, not just taken, he had managed to leave to leave the home. He had gone to a work site, and he made the police officer arrest him, who was also our neighbor and his friend. He said, if you're gonna here to arrest me, you better make it look good. And he got down on the ground and he made him handcuff him and take him and put him in the back seat of the police car. So that's a little insight to his personality. He was a big personality. But anyways, once he was there, he was interviewed, I guess, by two different psychiatrists, and they both deemed him completely unable to make his own choices, his own decisions. So he had to spend 3 days in the psych ward. And they called me and asked me to come to see him and to be there for one of his appointments. And I walk in there, and there's a guard, an armed guard at the door. There's blood all over the floor. I walk in, there's blood in his room. They had tried to give him an IV, and he after a while they were able to give it to him, but then he ripped it out, and it was just this big show that he had put on. But his psychiatrist told me that in his multiple decades of practicing medicine, that he had never once felt threatened by a patient until that day. Wow. Sitting in a room with Curtis. So that tells you a lot about how scary he was. So he spent 3 days in the psych ward, and he came home with a prescription for depression and a promise to go to future psychiatrist appointments, and none of those things ever came to pass. He pretended he was taking his medication, I later found out, but never actually took any, flushing the pills down the toilet so it looked like they were disappearing, but he never did. He never did take any of them. But, so after that, he just seemed to, he declined quickly after that. And it was scary for all of us. But while he was in the hospital, I had asked the doctor to check for a brain tumor, because I explained to the doctor, you know, he's done boxing a lot of his life. He was on his high school football team. He's actually had a couple of big hits to the head with his construction business. He's actually taken a hit to the forehead with a sledgehammer at one point. So a couple of really big hits. But they found nothing. They found absolutely nothing in any of the CAT scans or anything they gave him. So once again, we had no answers for what could happen. But when he did come home, he was super upset when he found out that I had taken all the guns out of the house. That just completely enraged him. And his first evening home, he was demanding that I give him the guns back, and I was refusing. And then he started throwing things at me, and I realized that my life was in danger, and I caved and told them where they were. And then as soon as I told them, because I had brought them to my parents' house, I realized that I had probably just endangered my parents' life, because I knew if he went over there, my dad wouldn't give them to him. And he was completely capable of hurting them. So I had, for the first time ever, experienced this panic attack. I had no idea what they were before, but you can't breathe, your chest just gets all tight, and I collapsed on the floor. And seeing me do that brought him back to the real world, and he became normal again. I was thankful for at least that. And he didn't bug me anymore for the guns that night. That was it. It was a mute point. But the next morning, his father called me and explained to me that I needed to give him the guns back. And I told my father-in-law, I said, I can't do that. If I do that, he's going to kill himself. My father-in-law reassured me and said, he's not going to do that. And he told me some stuff about my mother-in-law that I had never known before. But he said she would, when he would leave for work in the morning, she would threaten to kill the kids and herself and say, well, when you come home from work, you're going to find the kids in a bloody heap on the floor. And he would be worried all day, but every day he'd come home and everything was fine. She had never done anything. And so he explained to me that it's just a manipulation tactic, and he may have learned it from watching his mom growing up. He says, I don't know what it is, but trust me, he's not actually going to do it. And he said, plus, I believe you're safer if you give him the guns back. He'll be less angry. So I trusted that, and I brought the guns back in the house. And Curtis was happy when he came home and saw that his guns were back. And I was hoping maybe we were done with all of that, but of course we weren't. But after that, he became more suicidal. He was unsafe to drive with, so we were in the middle of building our home and living in Canada. We lived pretty close to the borders. Within a two-hour drive, we would cross the border quite often to get our supplies and save a lot of money, our building supplies. But he was dangerous to be in a car with. But there was one evening especially, we had driven to go get our appliances. And on the way home, maybe 10 minutes after picking up the appliances, I was so afraid in that 10-minute period of time, we stopped to get gas. And I called my daughter, who was... She was 21 at the time, and I told her, if me and Dad don't make it home because we died in a car accident, I need you to know that Dad did it on purpose. And I legitimately did not think I was going to see my kids again, and I told her I loved her, and I loved the kids, and it was the longest two-hour ride home because I didn't think I was going to make it home. But we made it home.
Wow.
We did make it home, And so that was just like one of the little things that had happened to us. His paranoia became ridiculously out of control. He was sure that I was having multiple affairs. At the time, I was Young Woman's president, and I had to be released. He would go to our bishop's house every morning at 6 a.m. and demand that I be released. He thought I was having an affair with the bishop and with the second counselor, and they had to finally release me. It was obvious that there was problems at home that I need to deal with before all the other stuff mattered. And I also, at one point, I had gotten a new job, and I was on day three of my training, and I had to quit because he was sure I was having an affair with someone that worked in the office. But he came into the lobby of the office building and demanded to see his wife. And it was a bank, so imagine someone walking into the lobby of a bank and demanding to see their wife. And so I had to quit because I couldn't. The embarrassment was more than I could handle. And
amazing. Was that just – do you think that was just part of his illness? Or was he just really always that jealous and suspicious, and it just got out of hand?
He was always jealous, but not to that extent. Like, that was he was just sure, he was convinced that I was having affairs with pretty much everyone that I saw. And if you knew me at all, you would know that is the most ridiculous thing ever. That is so out of anything I would ever be possibly capable of doing.
Right. So, well, I didn't know you then, but I do know you now. And I can't imagine that.
Yeah.
The furthest thing from it.
Yeah, it was.
Maurice, I want to touch for a second. You know, you're telling the story. How many years ago was this from then until today?
That was 10 years ago.
So this is 10 years ago, because you're telling this very matter-of-factly. You're telling this kind of calmly. I mean, every once in a while you're laughing at like kind of how absurd the whole thing was. But can you take us back for a minute? I imagine it wasn't calm or matter-of-fact or funny at the moment. I'm thinking of other people who are in domestic violence situations or this verbal abuse or this manipulation where you're in a car with someone you love and you're worried you're going to die by his erratic driving, or wondering how you can't leave him because if you leave him, you know, he really could go do crazy, horrible things. And I don't want to get lost in that for too long, but can you describe a little bit of that, where you were, your mindset, your, not necessarily your paranoia, but what was your mental state reacting to his paranoia, reacting to his violence, reacting to his being suicidal? How did that wear on you? I mean, I can't imagine even the strongest person being worn down by months and months, if not a couple of years of that.
Well, it all becomes quite ridiculous. Like, to me it did. It was just like, oh, come on. Like, what more could there be? It's just almost like something you can wave off and not really acknowledge. It just becomes so matter-of-fact every day. Like, you just know something crazy is going to happen. And it probably wasn't until... So in Canada, we celebrate Thanksgiving in October. And my oldest daughter was home, and she's someone that I have a huge amount of respect for. She's all the good parts of me and her dad in this one little human being, and she's given me courage to do a lot of things in my life, like just to be the mother that she has needed. And we were on our way to my sister's home for Thanksgiving dinner, and it's about a half hour from our home, and Curtis had just done this most ridiculous thing driving and endangered not only our lives in the truck, but the people that he almost ran into. And she just yelled at her dad and said, you know, with some a few expletives in there, but like, pull the crap over and let me out of this vehicle. And at that moment, I remember feeling so proud of her that she had the power to do that because I didn't have that power. And so when he pulled over into a parking lot, and I had to make that decision right then and there. Do I leave with her and have like a show of solidarity, really? Or do I stay in the truck with my other kids and leave my daughter alone to fend for herself? And he pulled over and we all got out. And Curtis was shocked. He was shocked that I would leave him. But we just all got out and shut the door. And he took off without a second thought and went back home and left us all there in the parking lot. And I called my sister and she came and got us. But it was
so
just sort of...
that was the October of the year he died. So yeah. You're within a couple months.
Yeah.
This is really getting to where everything's intensifying.
Yeah.
But your daughter was able to kind of show that courage and say, no, enough.
Yeah.
Even when you... couldn't or didn't know how you could.
It becomes so commonplace that you don't realize it's dysfunctional.
I think that's such a good way to put it.
And as you were saying, I mean, things were really good in the beginning.
Yeah.
This is like 3 years. It's a slow progress, right? He wasn't abusive. He wasn't these things. And so you're seeing these changes in him, but they're slow.
Right.
And you're thinking, we've got to figure this out. I want to save my marriage. I want to help my husband. I love him.
Right.
I want to do what's right for my family. And I think that's probably most women who deal with domestic violence.
And there's also another layer to it as well, too. When you get married young, and so I started having babies really young, I didn't take the time to get an education. And my whole life depended on Kurt and him being able to take care of us. And so I also had the thought of, if I do leave, how do I take care? How do I pay for my family? How do I do any of it? I'm completely 100% dependent on him.
Right.
On every level.
Which is, I think, a lot of reasons that women don't often leave.
Right. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I would say it's the number one reason, actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most definitely. So, yeah. So that was... just a little glimpse. I'm not kidding when I say daily that weird stuff like that was happening, but that's what it was like. And then, you know, that brings us up to Christmas time. Our son was going to school in the States and he had come home for Christmas break. And so we have all four kids in the house, which hasn't happened in a very long time. And so Christmas was stressful. We had... that's a whole nother story in and of itself that I won't even get into, but Christmas Day was quite terrible. I mean, there was a lot of fighting. There was our whole home. There was not a second of peace in it at any given time. But right after Christmas, my 13-year-old son was going on a winter camp, and he had waited till that evening to pack and needed his dad's help. We had our home, and then we had another piece of land right next door where we stored all the work equipment, and we had sheds full of like the camping equipment and different things. And it's Canada, it's December, there's lots of snow, it's cold, it's dark, and my son wanted help to go out there to get his camping stuff, and my husband wouldn't help him. He just refused to help him. So to get back at him, he went and got cases of his Coke and buried him in a snowbank outside. Well, that just infuriated his dad, and they got into a fight. And when I say a fight, like, you might just think normal fight, husband and father is like a yelling match. Not in our house. My boys were raised wrestling their dad, and it was always a bone of contention in our family because it was always so violent. It wasn't like, you imagine father and son wrestling on the floor. It's like this fun thing. Dad lets the son win, you know, normally, right? No, not with us. It was always, it ended with, most of the time, with blood. And me yelling, like, stop this, to the point where I just stopped yelling, would just walk out of the room. But it was always really violent. And so those two start wrestling, and... my son punches his dad in the back of the head, and that ended that one. And then Curtis comes to me later and he says, what are you going to do about that? That kid needs to be punished for that. And I just said, I can't do anything about that. I've been yelling for 16 years that that's not appropriate. You have fostered this feeling of anger and hate and resentment in your boys by treating them like this, and now it's the natural consequence of what you've done. At this point, I can't do anything. And that was the end of that conversation. And my sister and her boys were over, and a little bit later, like maybe an hour or so later, my nephew came up to me and he said, "Auntie, you know, Uncle Curtis is trying to kill our 13-year-old son." And so I ran to where he said they were. He said they were out in the garage, that his dad had drug him out to the garage. And so I opened the door. The lights were off, but I opened the door just in time to see my husband laying our son down on the ground, and he's got him in a chokehold, and my son is like passed out. And so I get Curtis off of him, and our son comes to, he's not passed out anymore, and he starts screaming like, I want him out of here. I'm not spending a night in this house with this man. He just tried to kill me, and I'm trying to calm him down, and Curtis is just standing there with his arms folded, not saying a word, like completely clueless to what he's done is wrong. And so I don't know what to do.
Did you feel that he would have killed him had you not walked in at that moment?
I honestly do. There was this coldness. So, we'll go back to a couple of months. When he was in the hospital in the psych ward, I had brought my in-laws with me. And they went in to talk to him. His dad went in there to talk to him, and he came out and he said, "I don't know who that is in that room, but that's not my son. It's not. It was like he could. His eyes would like glaze over, and it was like no one was there. The man I knew wasn't there. It was just someone who was completely unfeeling, just not there.
Just not there. That had to be so intense. I can't imagine walking in and seeing my son being laid out on the ground by his own father. Like I can't. Yeah.
And you'll hear.
I can't fathom that.
You'll hear abused women say that they knew at one point. They knew when it was time to go, and that was my moment. That's when I knew, and it was. It's not just a moment where you realize, okay, this is over. It's also an acceptance of, okay, everything I've spent the last 23 years building, like financially, mm-hmm. is gone. Like you come to a point where you're okay with leaving all that behind, knowing that the road ahead is going to be hard, but it's all okay. Like you can do it. You'll start from scratch, but that the safety of your kids and yourself, and you just have to be done. You just have to be done. And that was my moment there.
Wow.
And so I just told my son, just go to camp. Like you can tonight spend the night in your brother's room, and then we'll get up in the morning, go to your winter camp. You'll be gone for a few days, and I'll have this figured out by the time you get back. And that was the only thing to calm him down. And so that's what we did. He went to camp the next morning. I got up. I had to work that day. I'd gotten a different job, this time at our pharmacy in our town, which was less threatening to Curtis because he could walk in at any moment, see me there, knew I was where I was. And so he had agreed to allow me to do that. So that was much better. But so I had gotten up. I had gotten in the shower, showered up, and then called social services. I'd actually called our bishop first and told him what had happened. And he said, I'll give you 24 hours to call social services because I am legally obliged. I have to report it. What he has done is abusive, and it's illegal, and he has to be reported. So I will let you, I'll give you the first chance to do it. If you cannot, I will have to do it. And at the time I knew, and our bishop was also our friend. He was a good friend of Curtis's. And I knew that if I let him do it, that I was actually putting his life at risk too. So I knew I had to do it. So I call social services, no answer. I leave a message on the phone, and then I go to our room. So we had moved into our new house about 3.5 weeks earlier, completely unfinished. No trim, hardwood still was incomplete on probably half of the house. Cupboards, like the base ones were in, upper ones, I still had some that had to get put up, like completely, completely unfinished. So, and we only had one working bathroom, that was in the basement. So I come upstairs and I try to get in our room and I cannot get into our room. And I can see through the door frame where there should be trim, but I can see that Curtis has screwed a piece of hardwood across our door, the inside of the door, so that I can't get in. And he's sitting on our bed and he has a gun in his hand. And so I'm trying to talk to him through this little crack in the door, and it takes me about an hour to talk him down to a point where he will come and let me in. And then I just sit on the bed with him, and we discuss, and I say, okay, we need to go to the doctor today. Let's make an appointment. And he agreed that he would take the antidepressant medication, and so we get all that going. I go to work. He goes to the doctor, and then he comes into the pharmacy to fill his prescription while I'm working. And he's stoic. He's hard. Like, he's got those eyes that don't have a soul behind him. He's scary. And he fills a prescription, and he looks at me, he turns and looks at me, and he says, and the pharmacist, so this is a small town, you got to remember this. So the pharmacist I've known my whole life, he's known Curtis for over 20 years, and Curtis turns to me and he said, did you call social services? And because I had told him I was going to call while I was at work, while I was on a break at work. And I said, no, I haven't had an opportunity yet. It's been a busy afternoon. And he just deflated, like just right in front of me, just like his shoulders weren't as tall. He just kind of deflated. And he said, oh. And then he left. And the pharmacist said to me after, he said, what is going on with him? What is happening? And so I told him, I gave him a little glimpse into my life and what was happening. And he just said, Maurice, if you need anything at all, just let me know. I had no idea you were going through all of this. But it was obvious. You talked to Curtis for 2 minutes, and it was obvious something was wrong. But so we went, I think it was the next day. The next day is the day was Christmas or New Year's Eve day, and my son was coming home that day. Sorry, I tried not to say their names, but I went to work again that day, and that night we went to a New Year's Eve party that was at our bishop's home, and we had a great time, and Curtis was relaxed, and he just seemed back to normal, and it was wonderful. And then we got this call from our oldest son, who said that his brother had come back from his winter camp, and they had gotten into a fight, and that his younger brother had pulled a knife on him, and that the two older kids were going to their own New Year's Eve party together. It was a group party for all the youth in our community, and it was an hour away from where we live. So we knew we had to get home soon, and I didn't know what I was going to say to my son. I had resolved absolutely nothing while he was gone. I had called social services every day, morning and afternoon, while he was gone. No one had ever answered my calls. I had left multiple messages, and nothing. I didn't know what to do, but our oldest son was supposed to go back to school the next day, January 1st. He was supposed to return to school, and he wasn't going to leave. He's like, Mom, I can't leave you with all of this. But I didn't want it to be a burden on my kids, and I was so excited for them to have that opportunity to get an education, to be out of the house, and I was able to tell him, it's okay, everything's going to be fine. And so he was still going to go. But anyways, we get back home. I go into my son's bedroom and say, what's happening? Why'd you pull a knife? How was your trip? Like, just trying to talk to him. And he's agitated. And then Curtis comes a couple minutes later and just announces to me, to our son, to our little 9-year-old daughter. He said, when social services gets here, I'm going to request that you be taken, removed from our home. And I just gasped. I look over at my 13-year-old son, who is literally climbing his bedroom wall. Just so... can you imagine being that age and being told that you're going to be put into a foster home? I can't imagine the horror that poor kid felt. And our little 9-year-old, she just jumped up into her dad's arms and said, Daddy, please don't do this. And that little something clicked in my brain, like, okay, this is... No more. Like I keep saying, I can't get help. I don't know what to do. I'm feeling completely lost, completely alone, really. Like I have no resources, nothing left. And I just realize he has to leave, like right now. Like this cannot go another second. Because I'm not losing my children because of my husband. It's not happening. And so I peel our daughter off of him, I take him by the hand, and we walk across the house, we go into our bedroom. And in our bedroom, we had this big walk-in closet, and then through the walk-in closet, we had built a secret room underneath the stairs to the loft that was going to be our gun storage. And I kind of stop in front of our closet door and I said, you need to pack a bag and go. And he looked at me just shocked and said, those are the last words he said to me, are you kidding me? And I said, no, you need to pack a bag and go. And he walked right past me, walked into our closet, walked into the little room we had behind it. And I remember thinking, we don't have any bags in there. What is he doing? What is he doing? And then he just, with his left hand, reached up, grabbed a pistol that he must have had hanging on the wall there somehow, and awkwardly just like turned the pistol around and shot himself in the chest. And I just stood there like what? I just remember seeing this light coming off of the gun and then just running. I just ran out of the room. And as I ran out of the room, I saw run out of his room bare feet, December 31st in Canada, and just jumps, because we didn't even have our porch built on our front of the house yet. It was just a door. And just jumped off into the snow and ran away. And I grab a phone to call 911. I can't even remember how to call 911. Like, the complete shock has set in. I remember seeing my hand shaking with the phone in it and not, I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember the number. And so I went to see where my daughter was, and she was just sitting on the floor in her brother's room, and she was just sitting there looking at her hands. And I told her to pack a bag, and it was funny because for the past 3 weeks we all had bags packed. I had them packed, and they were in the kids' cubbies. I had told them, you know, pack a bug out bag. Like, that's how worried I was, that we knew we needed an emergency bag, but I still stayed there, and I have lots of reasons why I stayed there, but now 10 years later, I still just shake my head. It's almost pathetic that I stayed, but I feel like I didn't. To this day, I don't really feel like I had another choice.
It sounds like you didn't really have the resources. Whether
no.
Even people at church may have known, or the bishop may have, but were they providing you resources? Were they saying counseling? Were they saying, let's get you help? Let's get help for the children?
No, there was nothing like that. I mean, I had people telling me, you need another cell phone that he knows nothing about, and have mm-hmm. numbers, you know, contacts in there so that you can call us. And I do remember getting a phone and hiding it in between my mattress and box spring. I do remember having that. And I know that my dad was, he didn't tell me at the time, but he told me after that he was actually the next day was going to go talk to the police, because he was
like
so
afraid.
It sounds
like you didn't have anyone to like help you formulate a plan. And
no.
It seems to me that women in domestic violence situation, at least what I've read, what I've heard, you have to have a plan. Like you talked about earlier, you know, this is your financial life. This is all of the things that you hoped and dreamed you'd built up together. You don't have your own income. You don't have your own ability to care for yourself. And so you needed to figure out that bridge, right? You needed to get from where you are relying on your husband to how am I going to provide for these kids? And nobody was providing you information of how to build that bridge.
Right. But I don't know if proud is the right word, but I did not at that time take help easily. Mm-hmm. This is my problem. I need to deal with this. I didn't want to burden anybody else with that.
I think that's a lot of it too, from what I've seen in different domestic violence situations and abusive things, where even if you had a resource or someone was out there, you know, the pharmacist, your boss, somebody offering help,
right,
it's inside your head. Like you said, this has been day to day your reality. You're trying to solve it, you're trying to fix it, you're trying to downplay it or to hide it. You're not really seeing it clearly. Like you said, even 10 years later, you'll look back and think, oh my gosh, what was going on? Imagine being in that. So I think there's lists and lists of reasons
right.
people stay in those complicated situations. And sometimes the resources aren't there, but sometimes the resources are there, but the getting you to leave, to not just pack a bag, but to actually walk out that door, so difficult for anyone that's ever lived, not just in a physically abusive situation, but the emotional, verbal abuse, the manipulation. Manipulation is mind warping
mm-hmm,
to
mm-hmm.
where you can't get out. You can't explain away. You are trapped, I mean, maybe is the best word.
That is a really good word.
Yeah.
That describes it. It is trapped.
Yeah.
It is trapped.
I don't want to end with you. I guess part of me thinks that you said it was pathetic that I didn't leave. And I think a lot of women maybe look back and feel that way. But at the same time, it is a process, like Jenny's saying. It's a process, and it's a distortion of your reality. So, you know, it's trying to get from point A to point B, and how do you get there? I think it's just a lot more difficult than just leaving. Just leaving sounds easy.
Right.
It sounds like, why don't they do it? And we all think that.
But to where?
That's right.
Just it. Leave to where?
To where? And how? How do
and to
I
get
do
away
it?
Away from him, because wherever you go, he'll probably be able to
find you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
complicated.
So this horrible tragedy happens. He's now just shot himself in your closet with you right there.
And I don't know if he's dead.
Okay, so what happens next? And then obviously 10 years later, like, you're sitting here, you're smiling, you have a beautiful countenance about you. I see qualities of resilience in you that I would imagine have come over those 10 years and probably through a lot of those really bad years that maybe you're able to exhibit now. So tell us more about what happened that day. And then I think the big question everybody else has is, and then what? Oh my goodness, then what? It's New Year's Eve day. He just shot himself. What happens next? And then what did you and the kids do?
Well, I finally am able to remember how to call 911. And I'm on the phone with the dispatcher, and she just keeps telling me, just flip the porch light on and off so that the help can come. Just stay put. Help will come. Help will come. And so I've told my daughter to pack a bag. I'm watching her, you know, get things ready. And she's strangely not packing anything, any clothes. She's putting in her snow globe. She's putting in things that make her feel good, memories of special things. But so I'm, you know, I'm flipping the light on, and I can see the siren lights outside my home. So I know the police are there, but no one's coming in. And then suddenly this very angry police officer cuts in on the line, and he's yelling at me, get out of the house, get out. And so I hang up, and then I grab my daughter, and I realize, well, I can't jump out of my front door and carrying this little girl. I need shoes, I need a jacket. And I have to walk back through my house, back past my bedroom door. And I don't know if it was real, but in my mind, I can smell blood. I can smell it. And even now, I've gone back to that house one time since, and I could still smell the blood. It's like, it's a very real, real thing. And I'm freaked out because I'm imagining that I'm going to see blood seeping from underneath the wall into the hallway. And of course I didn't, but so I walk carefully with my daughter. We walk back through the house, back to the back door, get our stuff.
And you're
stuff.
Still not confident at this time that
I'm still not. I'm still not.
But did you go in there and try to check on him? No.
No way.
You thought that if you went in there, maybe he'd kill you if he wasn't dead.
I didn't know if it was safe. I didn't know anything.
Right.
So we finally get out. The ambulance is parked a couple houses down from us, and someone comes and grabs my daughter. They say they're going to bring her to where her brother is, which is across the house at a neighbor's house. And I go into the ambulance and tell the EMT and the police what had happened, and we're taken to another neighbor's house, and that's where we end up spending the night. But I was amazed at when I got there, there was already so many people from our neighborhood were already there. And you know, good friends of mine, my son's young men's leader was there, and how word got around so quickly. But then they were telling me, we saw the lights, and we knew something had happened, and our whole family immediately got on our knees and prayed that you and the kids were okay. So I remember thinking that was so weird that everyone was so aware of how much danger we were in, but I was so nonchalant about it. Like, I was just, I didn't have a grasp on how bad it was. But yeah, so people just kept coming in, and then I knew I had to get my older kids, because they still didn't have a clue. And I was told to call them, get a hold of them, but I could not tell them what had happened. Because if they knew, they wouldn't be able to drive home. It was more dangerous for them to know at this point, because it was an hour-long drive in Canada on Canadian roads at night. It wasn't safe. And so when I did get a hold of my oldest daughter, I was like, honey, you need to find your brother and come home. And she's like, Mom, what happened? And I'm like, I can't tell you what happened. Just come home. And I so wish I would have told her, you know, me and the kids are okay, but you need to come home. But I didn't say that. And so I'm waiting for them. And then the police officer, who's our neighbor, and he's the same one that arrested Curtis 3 months earlier. And he comes in and he says, Maurice, I need to tell you that Curtis is deceased. And I just sat there, like didn't say anything. People all around me are crying and moaning, and I've got no emotion. I've got nothing. And then he takes me to one of the bedrooms and is like, I need to know what happened. And so he's asking me, okay, so what happened? So I tell him about the gunshot. And then he said, and there was only one gunshot? And he asked me in a way that I had to pause. And I went, oh, just wait. There was two, wasn't there? And he said, yeah, there was. And then I suddenly remembered that as I was running out of the room, I heard another gunshot, and I looked behind me to the wall because I thought he was trying to shoot me through the wall. But it's amazing to me that when you're in shock, that memory was completely instantly taken away from me. And had the police officer not kind of led me to that, I don't think I'd ever remember it. Like, I wonder what else I have forgotten from that night.
Right.
But it's completely, completely interesting to me.
Wow.
that how quickly the body shuts down. And I don't know if it's protecting the brain, I don't know what it does, but it was very real. So I had to give my statement, and then I found out a year later, I got a letter from the police officer that was in charge of the whole investigation, that I was actually under investigation for a whole year because of the two gunshots, that they thought that I had done it. And I'm thankful that I never knew that before. I would have probably never left my house. I'd have been so afraid. But yeah, it was an amazing thing. And the other weird thing that Curtis did, I didn't find out till quite a few years later either, was he had had a conversation with our youngest son. So this boy is 13 years old, and his dad is sitting there telling him, if you ever commit suicide, make sure you don't shoot yourself in the face, because then you won't be able to have an open casket. And
wow.
Well, I mean, what a
horrible thing.
Horrible thing to talk to your child about.
Right.
But it also explained why he did what he did. He probably was trying to preserve his face and realized that wasn't going to work, and so had to do it again. But to have that kind of strength, which also talks a lot about, says a lot about Curtis and how strong he was, to shoot yourself twice is just unreal. But so that was that night. We spent the night there, and it was interesting because the next day, so that whole last few months, our family was almost being terrorized. Like, we were in constant fear. But the next day, that fear was completely gone. Completely gone. Like, we were sad, but there was this peace that me and my kids had that was palpable. Like, people would come to our house and they wouldn't want to leave because me and the kids were happy, and there was just this feeling like just of absolute peace and safety, and we could laugh and we weren't really worried about anything.
You weren't under that stress from having really the love of your life that turned into really a monster living with you.
Exactly. I mean,
it was gone.
The next day was also the start of holy cow, how do I do this? We had this. Right. I had this huge house that I had to try to finish myself, which I'm thankful that Kurt, I was the finished carpenter anyways. He had taught me how to do all of that, but it was still a huge project. We had three rental units that were all claiming that they had paid Kurt cash the day before. And that he somehow, I mean, I went through all his pockets, like his coat pockets. I didn't go through his clothing or anything, but after his coat pockets, thinking, well, maybe he did take this in cash, but I never found anything. So they were all just trying to take advantage of me. So I had these three properties that I had to now completely take care of. We had a construction business. Our main employee was married with three little kids, and I felt completely responsible for him, but I couldn't keep that going very long. So I had this whole business that I had to sell equipment and get rid of.
A lot of work.
And the most important was get me and my kids counseling.
Right.
Like, that was my number one priority. And yeah, it was a difficult, that first year was was incredibly difficult, but I had so much support from our community, you know, my friends, my family. Like, it was a difficult time, but an amazingly spiritual time as well. Almost the spirituality and the miracles I feel happened to us out kind of evened out the horrificness of what we were experiencing. But
can you tell us a little about that? Because that you completely piqued my interest. So my husband died a little over 2 years ago, and nothing horrific. It wasn't, the backstory is very different from yours, but the fact of the matter is he's gone, and the kids and I are without him. And I look back over these 2 years and I find myself thinking that same thing, the blessings, the personal growth, the insight or the progress that I've made or that I've seen, the miracles, literal miracles in my life, mm-hmm. really do seem to counter the tragedy, which I will admit really surprises me. And sometimes kind of I almost feel bad about to say this has been an amazing couple of years of wonderful blessings, and I've grown so much and I've learned so much. And then I think, wait a second, it's because of this huge, horrible tragedy that started all of this. But I think that's something about resilience, Michelle. You and I have talked about several times the resilience of looking for the good, letting there be good, finding the good in those tragedies. So can you tell us a little bit about what's your resilience been? What's worked for you? What have you discovered? You're now a decade in. These memories, these experiences never go away, no matter how much time passes. But I'd love to hear a little more about that and some of these experiences you have had that have strengthened you, and maybe some of the tricks and tips of resiliency that maybe you could share with some of our listeners.
Well, for me, what worked, and it may not work for anyone, it's because of my strong faith, I'm sure, that it worked. But first of all, I had to learn to give up control. I very much try to control what is around me, and I had to realize that I actually have no control over anything. I had to let other people, I had to allow them to help me, which was a big thing for me to do, a really big thing. But what I've learned is that people want to help. They really do want to help. And that's the only, they don't know what to say or do, like, or do after a tragedy like this happens. But if you let them help, they'll do anything for you. And it just it makes them feel better, makes you feel better. But that was probably the first hurdle I had to get over. The other thing was that I really learned, I had heard in the past this enabling power of the atonement, and I didn't really understand what it was, but I really had to figure it out. It just was something that was in the back of my mind that was like, okay, so what is this? I'm going to see if I can figure it out. But I had to realize that it actually gives us strength to overcome things and to do things that we could never have done on our own. And I learned that my Savior not only atoned for my sins and all of our sins, but he also atoned for the unfairness, the pain, the anguish, the emotional distress that each one of us as human beings will go through in our lives. Like, he's already felt that. He's already experienced it. All I had to do was let go of all of it and have enough trust, enough faith in him that he would have my back if I just gave it over to him. And that's a scary thing. It's like falling off a cliff. I just had to absolutely, okay, here it is. I can't do all this. I don't know what to do, but I'm just going to give it to you and trust that you'll give it back to me in bits that I can handle. And that's what happened. Every day, I just got up and did that.
I love that so much. I'm a Christian like you, and I look to Jesus Christ as not just a person, not just a teacher, but literally a Savior. And I love how you've kind of broken down what he might save us from, and your belief in God and your belief in this being that's obviously larger than you, obviously more powerful than you, more loving than I think most of us could ever describe with words. But to say, I think for a lot of people in and out of the Christian faith, they look to Jesus Christ as the person who made all the sins wash away. And that's true, really big, really important. But for you to say, your faith in him has helped you deal with the unfairness of this.
Yeah.
And the emotional weight of this and the disappointment and the heartache. I mean, wow. That to me is true faith. Like you said, it's that you're falling off that ledge trusting someone's going to catch you, not just for the things you did wrong or mistakes you made, but for the fact that this life really is unfair. And bad things happen to good people all the time. And you, I love how you broke that down, that your faith helps you be okay with the fact that some things aren't fair and that some things are a total ripoff and that life hurts and that there's anguish and pain. I am blown away. I just think that is such a beautiful, again, a breakdown is the only word I can think of what your faith in Jesus Christ offers you above and beyond the idea that your sins can be washed away. There's so much more to your faith than that.
Yeah.
Well, and I've gotten to know you, and actually how I met Maurice was I attended a wedding for my friend's son, and it was the first event I'd gone to without my husband after John died, and I was really nervous. I felt very uncomfortable. I was at a wedding alone, and I was introduced to Maurice and her new husband, Todd, and they invited me to come sit with them. And it was such a simple act, but I was ready to leave right as they asked me to come and sit with them. And you know what is striking to me, I didn't know your story at the time, the largeness of the story. But what's striking to me is that you're not angry. I mean, a lot of people in your situation could justifiably carry a bag of anger with them that was palpable. You had loved this man and he was your knight or your hero or your bigger than life husband, and you had hopes and dreams, and they were robbed not only from you but from him and your children, and it would be justifiable to be so angry. But you're not.
No, definitely not angry. Well, I also feel very blessed because a lot of you read about other families that have experienced this, and quite often the husband will take the entire family with him.
Right.
That's true.
Yeah.
And I just feel I feel overwhelmingly blessed. So a few days before he died, I did have an experience where I told my Heavenly Father I couldn't do it anymore. And I had the most incredible spiritual experience where he filled me full of Christ's love for Curtis. Like, I felt that. It was the most overwhelming. And I knew that Curtis was loved. It didn't matter what he did, it didn't matter. He was still a most beloved, beloved, beloved son of God. Yeah. And it filled me, it filled me full of the love, and I had that love when Curtis died. I was still filled with it. It was so overwhelming, and I can't be angry. I can't be angry at that.
Yeah,
I feel like we were saved. I feel like, I mean, like you said, I loved Curtis no matter what. Although we may not have been safe around him anymore,
right?
We're okay.
That's awesome.
We're okay.
We're going to need to take a break. When we come back, there is one more part to the story that we need to get to and give us some insight as to what you discovered about what led Curtis to this massive change in personality and how he got to be where he was, which wasn't discovered until after his passing. We're going to be right back. And we're back with Maurice, and she has shared with us a heartbreaking, tragic story of love, of loss, and deep emotional pain and scars and trauma and horrific impact to her family, the loss of her husband by suicide. Not only did he shoot himself once, but he actually shot himself twice. He really wanted to make sure that he was going to die that night. And it's an intense story. And as you're telling us the story and sharing with us your faith in Jesus Christ and your love for him and your prayers that went answered and filled you with love for your husband. And share with us
that ending part, the part of the story we haven't heard yet, of where you found some, at least, answers, probably a little bit of, like, salve to your soul as to what happened to this man that you love so much who became so angry.
Yeah, well, a few months after his death, I was online and I was happened upon this article, and it was about Shane Dronet, and he had a beautiful wife and two beautiful daughters. He was an NFL player, and he took his own life. And as I was reading this story, it has his wife's description of what he was like those last few months, and at that last moment, she had just come home from a trip with her girls and walked in. And he had a gun in his hand, and she knew what he was about to do, so she backed out, shut the door, and she heard the gunshot go off. But she describes the look she saw in his eyes, and I just thought, that's Kurt. Like, that is absolutely Kurt. And it was a story about CTE. And through reading this article, I was able to, you know, find out that he, being an NFL player, she had donated his brain to Boston University, to their neurology and pathology division. And
Maurice, tell us what CTE is.
Well, it stands for, hopefully I can say it properly, chronic traumatic encephalopathy.
Okay.
And so it's the brain after it receives brain trauma. And it doesn't have to be concussions. It can just be kind of when the brain hits the skull, it kind of has like almost like, I hate to be the one to explain it, but it's almost like, imagine like an elastic band, and it creates, when it gets stretched and comes back, it creates this protein called tau protein. And over time, it takes years for it to develop, but it creates damage in the brain, and you can't see it while the person is alive. You can only dissect it after and do a special test. So it doesn't show up on any CT, on any CAT scan or anything. So I had read this and thought, okay, Curtis had to have had this. Like, this is unbelievable. And so I email Boston University, and I actually get someone that answers me back. And she was more than willing to help me. And it was interesting, after Kurt died, I was so sure that there was something wrong with him that I requested an autopsy, which is odd. I mean, if someone kills himself, they're not going to do an autopsy, but mm-hmm. I specifically requested it because I was sure there was something wrong with him. And of course, it all came back negative. There was nothing wrong with him. But they after the autopsy, they actually save parts of the brain when they do an autopsy. Actually, different parts of the body they will save parts of. So Boston University contacted our coroner, and the coroner actually had two large chunks of Kurt's brain that he had saved that was never buried with him. I was shocked to find out. And they sent it to Boston and the university. And so they did the test, and it took probably about 8 months to get the results back. But when we got the results back, Curtis had moderate to severe damage in his frontal lobe. So he had CTE. At 40 years of age, he had CTE. So, and that was an absolute answer to us. Like, a lot of families, especially with suicide, you're just left with these questions of the why. And I just feel really blessed that our family had this answer, that we had the why. It's not because he didn't love us. It's not because he didn't care. It's not because he didn't want to be with us. He absolutely had no choice. Like, there was something wrong with him. So I struggled because there was nothing. There was absolutely nothing about CT 10 years ago, like nothing available to me. But now it's like there's been a movie, a very popular movie with Will Smith called Concussion that goes into detail what it's all about. And there is a documentary called Head Games that actually, I know in Canada, it's shown in all the high schools. That talks about CTE. And I was contacted by the producer of that show before we got our results back. He wanted to know all about Curtis and our story, and he wanted to film from Boston University the telephone call when I got it to tell me the results. And I didn't know what the results were going to be at this point, but I should have had a pretty good idea if, if the guy that's doing the documentary wants to do it. But so anyway, so if you watch the documentary, there's a little blurb about our family, and you can actually listen to the telephone call of when I got the results. And it's heartbreaking. You see Dr. Ann McGee, she like lays, because after she tells me what it was, I thanked her for giving us some sort of peace, because now we knew the answer as to why. And she just lays on the phone, and it's like she's trying to give me a hug from so many miles away. But it's an emotional, I watch it even now. I just watched it about a month ago, and it still made me cry to this day to watch it. But yeah, I would admonish everyone to watch that documentary before you put your kids into sports, because it's not just the professional athletes that are getting CTE, it's amateur athletes. Curtis was never a professional athlete, but soccer players, MMA players, football players, like a lot of people are finding out that they had CTE, and they're finding more and more research that they're able to at least diagnose it now and mm-hmm. not have to wait until that person has died.
Is that available on YouTube?
It might not be. I don't know if it's on YouTube. I know it is on Amazon.
Okay.
So Head you can Games. Watch it. Yeah, Head Games by Stephen James.
Okay.
Very, very enlightening.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Probably a good thing for all of us to watch.
Yeah. And the other thing, too, is being a child of a parent that has committed suicide makes you 50% more likely to commit suicide. So that is something that I am constantly worried about with my kids. Like constantly, it's never going to go away,
right?
But and so there's an article on WebMD on signs of suicide that I am constantly just looking up, and maybe my kids might even think I'm a little extra paranoid, but I have reason to be. And
well, you love your kids, and certainly we don't want to lose anybody by suicide, and certainly you don't want to lose anyone else that you love by suicide again.
Yeah.
I think it's a tragic.
I think we brought up so many important topics today that we could go off on a whole other episode on each of these. One are the different layers of domestic violence and what that can look like and feel like. Another are the different layers of suicide. I think from the outside, it's sometimes really easy to look at someone who's committed suicide and think, oh, that terrible person, or oh, they were so selfish, or oh, your husband was such a monster. But if you've ever lived with that person and loved that person and experienced that loss, you know there's so much more to it. I love that you say you can feel that great, overwhelming love for your husband, knowing that he clearly wasn't in his right mind when he made the choices he made. I lost my dad to suicide when I was 10. And there's four kids in our family, two boys and two girls. And so this story really hits home. My father wasn't an athlete in the way that your husband was, but he had worked in construction. He had fallen from a ladder and hit his head quite hard years before. He had had a shunt put in. He had hydrocephalus, which is swelling on the brain, and was never the same after that. And like you said, 10, 20, 30 years ago, no one knew what we now are learning. And so I'm grateful for the advances in the medicine. But even without a brain injury, I would just caution all of us to be mindful of what we think we know about someone who chooses to take their own life, and that there's definitely more to it than probably you would see from the outside. And to be, I would say, extra sensitive to those who've lost someone to suicide. Because, you know, I've now gone through this. I lost my father as a child. I've now lost my husband's father as a wife. Completely different stories.
Mm-hmm.
Completely different stories. Because my dad died by suicide in 1990 when nobody talked about it. Completely shameful. Completely embarrassing. All you do is ask yourself why.
Mm-hmm.
All you do is ask yourself, what could I have done to prevent this? Versus, you know, my husband died at war in a uniform as a soldier. And completely different stories. But the bottom line is, those men are both gone.
Mm-hmm.
And they both left a wife, and they both left kids. And the grief of suicide, I think, adds so many layers of complexity. So I'm grateful that we are learning to talk about it,
mm-hmm.
because we haven't, as a society, been
Absolutely.
Comfortable talking about it. But I think, you know, Maurice, I've learned so much from you in just this past little hour or so about what resilience is. And I love that you said the first thing, first, was giving up control. I feel like it's the white flag.
Mm-hmm.
Surrendering that what I thought my life would look like is probably not what my life is actually going to look like. And some people might look at that as a weakness, or I'm giving up. I think it's the greatest strength. Like you said, the first step to take is to say, I'm not in charge.
Yeah.
I can't control it. I can't fix it. Does me no good to be angry about it. Where's that going to go? And but I love that you said that. I love that you cited your faith and that that's enabling to you. That's empowering to you. I can feel that in speaking with you. I love that you cited letting people help. I think that's highly underrated in our culture, the ability, the blessing of letting someone help you. And that sounds so selfish to say, I'll let you help me. But you know what I mean? Most of us, we've talked about this all the time, we're self-sufficient. I've got this. I'm fine. You're fine. When in reality, just what you said, Maurice, it blesses you and them, the people who are able to help you. It helps you. It helps them. We connect as human beings. We chip away all those layers of I'm fine, you're fine, and realize, man, life is hard. Your life, pretty hard. Your life, super hard. Man, I think we might have something in common here as humans experiencing this life. But I love what you've taught me. I'm sure our listeners have, we'll probably all have to listen to this 5 or 6 times because there's so many beautiful gems. But to hear the love in your voice, to see the hope, like I said, I get to look at you across this room and see the hope and the faith in your countenance. That inspires me so much as a widow, as a mom of children who've lost their father. I want to thank you for being as faithful as you are, as strong as you are, inspiring, and for putting it into words to say, here's what I did. I had to give up control. I had to let people help. I had to turn to Jesus Christ and not be angry. And be grateful. Oh my goodness. The gratitude. You're grateful for every medical thing they told you. A lot of people probably wouldn't be grateful to know that Kurt had CTE. They might find that to be something else to be bitter about, something else to blame. And yet you view it with gratitude. Oh my goodness, how awesome in the literal sense of the word is that, to have the mindset and the perspective to be grateful for all of that. I know I'm going to be thinking about that for days. So.
Yeah. Here I'm sitting across this table on control when you brought that up. It's like, here we are, three widows, very different story. Suicide, American hero, lost at war. My husband died from cancer, something that happens all too often. But I think that we all can really understand what it's like to have what we think is going to happen in our life or what we expect our lives are going to be. And then it's like, oh, it's not going to be anything like that at all. And that's one thing that we can all really relate to and understand, right? Yeah. It doesn't matter the story. You, as a widow, that's the reality. Your life, as you envisioned it, is no longer going to be that life.
I'm going to jump in and say I think that's true even for people who are not widows. You find me somebody that's 30, 40, or 50 years old that can tell me their life went exactly as they planned, and I'll take that person to dinner today.
Right.
Because I don't think any of us.
Well, and that's true,
you know,
right?
What I mean? Life is all about
adjusting
to sales.
But in a big way, right.
Sure.
In a big way, you get it really clear when you become a widow. It's like, oh, okay, there's other plans at foot here. So, you know, there's the line in a song, life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. And I've started to fall into that. I've started to kind of surrender to that. It's like, I can make all the plans that I want, but life is going to happen in between all of those moments. And I may not actually end up on that very last destination that I thought I was. The road may take some twists and turns.
Most definitely.
Thank you so much. Your road will take twists and turns. Yeah.
Yeah.
You create
will.
A new life.
Hate to spoil it.
That's
what it is. And I love, and again, maybe we can have you come back and talk about this new life you have created. Because it would seem from what I know of you, you've created a new beautiful life. And you still have the children who still have this history. And you've married again and found love and light and hope. And I think that would be wonderful to talk about kind of the what comes next. Because you still have a lot of years of life and health and everything here. So
absolutely.
But thank you very personally. Thank you for sharing this. Because like I said, this conversation really hits home in my mind and my heart. And for you to share it so openly is a gift for all of us who are listening. Because these are hard things to talk about. And I think they'll definitely bless a lot of people who hear this. So thank you.
You're welcome. Well, and thank you for being a friend to me and being one of those fellow widows that reached out and put your arms around me and embraced me and made me feel welcome and comfortable at an event that I really wasn't. It meant a lot to me. So thank you for passing on that goodness. And you're just such a wonderful person, and I'm excited to get to know you better throughout the years. And I really appreciate you coming in and sharing the story with us today.
Well, you're very welcome. And you're also very easy to be friends with, Michelle.
She is.
Well, thank you.
She's a friend magnet.
Yes.
Well, we want those of you who are listening to subscribe for free to the podcast. And if you like what you've heard, give us a rating and a review. If you or someone you know has a real story that they'd like to share about their lives, send us an email at rrpodcast@ksl.com. You can also find us on Facebook at Relentlessly Resilient. Remember, whatever you do today, remember to be kind. You have no idea the struggles other people are dealing with in their lives.